and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I'm pretty sure it's Monday. I'm not going to know for a while. You change the clocks by 1 hour. I don't know what day it is for a month. I'm terribly vulnerable to that time change, and I don't like it one bit. Our number is 888-318-7884. We're going to do some pro-life conversation this hour. If you'd like some help being persuasively pro-life, 888-318-7884. And of course, that means Trent Horn. Trent Horn here with us. He's an apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of the book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and this book right here, Why We Are Catholic. Trent Horn, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Cy.
It was nice to see you on the weekend.
I know. We were at the Founders Weekend Retreat in good old San Antonio, Texas. Stayed right nearby the Alamo. And I know it's funny, there were a fair number of people on that trip that did not get my "Where is the basement of the Alamo" reference. I couldn't believe it.
I'm not surprised. You have obscure movie references a lot. But
I have one question. Where's the basement? There ain't no basement in the alleyway. The thing that got me in that, this is, of course, in the classic Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where he thinks his bike is in the basement of the Alamo. Like, if you heard someone say, imagine if someone was like, "Where's the basement of Catholic Answers?" Would you just start, like, laughing at them hysterically?
I would not.
Because there's no basement to Catholic Answers.
I think that would be very rude to do that. I would not.
But I guess everyone in that scene, it is, like, the idea of the Alamo having a basement.
Well, people are mean to Pee-wee Herman. Yeah, you know something, Trent. When we do the pledge drives, I always say, "I don't know who gave this money for the matching money," and I this time when we do the pledge drive, I'm gonna know one of the people because a gentleman was very generous and
yes,
and I'll say it when it happens. But funded a full hour, and it was nice to meet the people who do that. We've never done a Founders Circle weekend out of the state of California before. It was very nice to go to Texas. Texas is easy to get to. Everybody flies there. And I've never been to San Antone before. Do you say San Antone or San Antonio? What do you Texans say?
I just say San Antonio.
Do you? And the entire reason they bring me, though, like, you give a talk and socialize and you're important because you're the entire reason I'm there is to insult wealthy people at the Saturday night dinner.
Well, Saturday night dinner, that's a grudge match because Saturday night we do Catholic trivia, and I'll just say that it was an enjoyable evening. That's all I'll say.
My voice is back now, but I've been struggling all day because all I did was it's kind of a Don Rickles thing, which is something like that. Wouldn't you say it's a little bit, you got to be in the spirit of it.
Oh yeah, but it was a great event, and anyone who was interested in participating in it should definitely contact Catholic Answers, our development department. Christine Venditti or Dave Matheson would be glad to be glad to speak with you. We'd love to have you join us in the next Founders Retreat.
Founders Circle, President's Club, all those folks that were, and a lot of folks can't travel to us, and I thought it was nice. We went to Texas. Maybe we'll go somewhere else. Texas is the number two state, almost the number one state as far as supporting Catholic Answers. So we went to see our donors and we had a very, very good time. And now my voice is gone from playing trivia, Catholic trivia, and insulting very, very nice people for a few hours. The number is 888-318-7884. Trent Horn is our guest. Persuasive pro-life is our topic. If you have a question about explaining and defending the pro-life position, you are welcome to call. Trent did a very nice talk with folks and kind of a lesson where we practiced it a little bit, having pro-life conversations with people. I thought it was interesting to hear how people put into kind of practice what you said. But it seemed to me like the primary thing was don't get distracted by all the stuff that people say, you know, to defend the pro-choice position. The primary thing is, is a life being taken? That's the primary question we always want to get back to.
Well, it not just is a life being taken, but what are the unborn? Because almost everyone agrees a life is being taken. The question is, what kind of life?
Yeah,
the question we need to answer.
Right, and so you kind of had us practice how to get back on that. And some people were very good at it. Some people struggled with it. But it's interesting when you can hear you do it, but to try to do it yourself, that's a different kind of challenge.
It's like being in seventh grade music class all over again. You can hear the scales, but somehow on the trumpet, you just can't quite get it. That was me, I guess. You might have had a different experience.
No, I was in choir, and so And it's extra humiliating when you can't do it singing. All right, the number is 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Persuasive pro-life this hour. Second hour, we've got a great guest for you as well. As a matter of fact, somebody, you go around the building, people say, who's on the show today? And you say, Deacon Harold. And all the men say, oh, I like that guy. Oh, I like that. It's the same exact response from everybody. Oh, I like that guy. So you'll like Deacon Harold as well. I'm going to go to Owen in San Francisco, California, listening on the Catholic Answers app. We'll start with you, Owen. Thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Trent. Thanks for taking my call. And you too, Si.
All right. Glad to have you.
I just had a quick question about how would you respond to someone who holds consistent to their pro-abortion views? For example, they'll say a child or a baby is not a human until they're able to process the world around them. And if you tell them, well, that's what about someone who is already born but is in some sort of vegetative state, is their life not valuable either? And they would say, no, their life is not valuable either. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, and this underscores the importance. When we dialogue about the issue of abortion and we argue about it, normally we kind of, both sides usually use this kind of an argument, which is typical in moral philosophy. We will say, okay, what's your standard for X? This is my standard. Okay, but your standard doesn't account for this counterexample. And so you either have to say that counterexample has nothing to do with my standard, or yeah, I'll bite the bullet. It doesn't work for that counterexample either. So typically what we'll do, like I taught people at the Founders Retreat, if you say, well, abortion should be legal because some children will be, they'll grow up in poverty. Okay, well, do you think we should kill two-year-olds who live in poverty? Most people will not bite the bullet there. So that's a counterexample. And the key when you bring up a counterexample is to try to pick one that is extremely sympathetic, one that everybody agrees, if it's a counterexample to show the immorality of something, to show, oh, well, yeah, we all agree that that's wrong. So if it's wrong to kill a two-year-old because they live in poverty, we should do the same for the unborn. But sometimes we pick counterexamples that themselves are controversial. So, for example, if someone says, well, I don't think a fetus is a human being because it's not conscious. And you say, well, what about Terri Schiavo? She was unconscious and she was in a persistent vegetative state and was never going to be conscious again. Was she a person? Many pro-choice advocates will say, no, she's not a person either. So you need to choose a counterexample to say, oh, yeah, that's, everybody agrees that's a person. Newborn infants are a great example because almost everybody, except for Michael Tooley and Peter Singer and some people, you know, wrote the Journal of Oxford and other places and odd people on the Internet, think that they are. Everyone else says that they're persons and killing them would be wrong. So I would change the example. I would say, you know, I wouldn't use someone in a persistent vegetative state. I might say, well, what about someone who's been put into a medically induced coma? Let's say they have brain swelling and a doctor has put them into a temporary coma and we know they will come out of the coma in a week, maybe. Are they no longer a person? Would it not be murder to intentionally overdose them? So it's, you always want to try to pick an example that's as close as you can. Also, the consciousness example, I would say, well, is your position that a person is anything that is conscious? If it's just any human that's conscious, that kind of begs the question, because consciousness is what's running the argument. I would pick like rats or pigeons. So once again, I would say if consciousness makes you a person, then rats and pigeons are persons, and killing them would be like murder. So here I'm using a counterexample, and I'm using an uncontroversial example. Sometimes I'll say dogs and cats, but some people are like, it is murder to kill a dog. I'm like, oh, okay. I understand you get attached to it. That's why I pick animals people are not very emotionally attached to. Rats and pigeons, which are flying rats, and maybe even snakes are conscious, other creatures like that. There it's uncontroversial that it's not wrong to kill them. So that would show the criteria for personhood is far too broad. So that might be kind of a route that I would take. Pick a clear example of a born person that's uncontroversially a person and yet lacks one of these personhood traits a pro-choice advocate requires. So is that a helpful start, Owen?
Yes, that's very helpful. And I definitely didn't think about the second part. So that's Yeah. I'll try and use that. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks very much. Got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Persuasive Pro-Life with Trent Horn. If you have questions about how to be persuasive in your pro-life conversations, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday and over 60 per week. They're the perfect companion for the busy Catholics everywhere. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off anytime, anywhere, and they're all free. Subscribe by going to EWTNradio.net, then click on podcasts. They're waiting for you. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Trent Horn and Persuasive Pro-Life this hour. If you've got a pro-life question, we'd love to take that call. Trent, of course, is the author of a book called Persuasive Pro-Life. He also wrote Answering Atheism and Why We're Catholic and many other books. Up next is Daniel in Hearst, Texas, watching on YouTube. Hi, Daniel. We were just in Texas. Glad to talk with you.
Hey, guys, how's it going? It's great to talk to you.
Very good to talk with you, Daniel. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Okay, so I was just thinking about this. Myself, being a straight white male, you know, it's very difficult to talk about really any political opinion, let alone abortion, especially on the streets. You know, women aren't going to take us seriously. They're going to say slogans like, no uterus, no opinion. Right, you hear that a lot. So what I'm thinking is, do you think we would be more effective in presenting our arguments we brought more women with us, but more specifically, minority women?
Well, first, I would say that choosing another person to make an argument based on their gender or race does not improve the argument in any way, shape, or form. The Catholic philosopher Francis Beckwith, I think it's in his book, Defending Life, or in his earlier book, Politically Incorrect Death, he says, and I'm going to keep this as family appropriate as possible, arguments don't have members. People do, if you get what I'm saying here, that an argument doesn't have a gender. Okay, arguments don't have genders, though he uses another anatomical term, that arguments also don't have. Arguments don't have these things. Arguments don't have genders. People do. Okay. So an argument, like I could make an argument and I could give it or I could write it down. In fact, I wouldn't write it down. I would just have Stephanie Gray give her own argument. It would be even better probably because Stephanie's a pro at this. But she could also give one of my arguments and it would be the same. An argument's strength does not rely in any way, shape, or form on the person making it. Now, if you're talking about being persuasive and reaching people, it is a fact of human nature that people can be a tad tribal, that they segregate themselves by ethnic groups, national groups, cultural groups. And so they're more likely to trust someone in the tribe than outside of the tribe. So if you want to just be able to reach people knowing they have these cognitive biases, then it can be very helpful to encourage other people to go out and to make these kinds of arguments, women, minorities, for example. Although what's interesting is I think many members of minority communities do make these arguments, actually, but they often make them, I'll get emails from people in other countries like Nigeria or Pakistan, people who are, you know, in the Philippines or other places, people will make these arguments where they would be considered a minority individual here, but they're not back in their own country. So I guess more it would be like people who live, an encouragement for everybody to speak out so that anyone who hears the arguments hears it from someone within their own community, and it's more persuasive. That's why I would definitely recommend anybody, but especially people from communities we don't hear from a lot in the apologetic world, women, other minority communities, anybody, go check out our schoolofapologetics.com, schoolofapologetics.com. And I have a course there on persuasive pro-life, on defending the pro-life view, that you can check out. But yeah, so it doesn't, technically speaking, it doesn't make the argument stronger, but it might make other people more open to hearing it. So I am all about equipping as many people in as many different communities as possible, all in favor of that. So I hope that's a helpful answer to your question. Daniel, you there?
Oh, sorry. I thought I was muted.
Yeah, sorry. I should have said, was that a helpful answer to your question?
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, it's not that it's going to make the argument stronger, but at least that it'll pull more people in who have biases towards certain groups of people, right? It'll pull them in, but, you know, not necessarily make the arguments better. We just all need to be equipped with good, reasonable-sounding points.
Right? Yeah, and I would love to get more people out there. And it's not just for pro-life, by the way. It's for any kind of argument in defense of the faith. I would like to see, I would thoroughly enjoy, I mean, I will be honest with you. I have heard from some individuals who are very critical that there are not as many public female Catholic apologists. And I would very much like to remedy that situation. So if you are a woman who would like to be more involved in apologetics to learn how to do it better, go to my website, trenthorn.com. There's a contact form there. You can contact me. I'll point you in resources, whether you're a member of a minority community or especially women. We would love to see you doing more work. And sometimes people say to me, well, why don't you involve more apologists in conferences or, you know, hire this person, hire that person. Well, here's how it works at Catholic Answers. Like, we brought on Joe Heschmeyer, who is a wonderful... Si, if I had to pick a word to describe Joe Heschmeyer, I'm going to pick the word jolly. I don't know what you would pick. Cheerful.
So it has to be a positive word.
That would be helpful.
Okay, let me think. Give me a few minutes.
Okay. Well, Joe Heschmeyer is an awesome guy. And one reason that we brought him on board at Catholic Answers was because Joe had a track record of doing really good apologetics. He was the author of the Shameless Popery blog for many years and is a wonderful apologetic blog with substance, with charity. And this is the kind of person that we want. So, you know, to grow in the world of doing apologetics, whether it's pro-life or others, it's good to establish yourself. Like, do YouTube videos, write blogs, get out there and do that and establish a portfolio. And if people might say, hey, Trent, here's this woman that does Catholic apologetics, pro-life apologetics, really good. I want to find out, or this person or that person. We're actually talking at Catholic Answers about creating an apologist affiliate program to kind of do part-time work with the people who are already out there doing apologetics. So if you're out there, get in touch with me. I want to grow the vineyard as much as possible. So that's our goal. So thank you so much, though, for calling in, Daniel.
Appreciate that very much. Charitable.
Yes, Joe is extremely charitable.
Okay.
And he's concise. He's been a great addition to the team. And he was fun to have in at the Founders weekend, actually. So that was nice. We were the two apologists. We were pulling the double duty, pulling the heavy reins for everybody.
Yeah.
We were the only two guys there.
Well, the thing about Joe, I don't know, Trent, how much time you spent around him, but he is relentless in punning. He is constantly making a pun, and he's really good at it. He finds the pun in everything.
It takes a certain kind of individual to make high quality puns. I'm not
saying they're all high quality. There's a lot of them.
Puns are that's an acquired taste for some people.
Aiden in Illinois, watching on YouTube, you are next. Persuasive Pro-Life, our topic, and the author of the book Persuasive Pro-Life, Trent Horn, is our guest. Aiden, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure. Very happy to, Aiden. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So my question was basically, what is the reason for accepting your definition of personhood, which I take as Boethius's definition?
Oh,
sure. Yeah. That the Boethius's definition is that a person is an individual substance with a rational nature. Well, there's different ways you can come to an understanding of why a definition is correct. I might say that I think the best reason to accept that definition is perhaps inference to the best explanation. Of all proposed definitions of a person, that definition, it does the best job of clearing two bars. It does the best job of not falsely saying non-persons are persons, like rats or pigeons. If you say personhood is tied to a very wide property like sentience or feeling pain, that would lead to counterintuitive results of non-persons, that things that we generally understand to be non-persons would be considered persons. So I think it does a good job of not falsely personalizing non-persons, and it does a good job of not excluding genuine persons from the circle of persons, if you will. Because other definitions of personhood will be very narrow. If they are just rationality, for example, you'll exclude beings we normally consider to be persons, like newborn infants. So I guess I might make an inference, the best explanation kind of argument, that it does the best of accounting for what we understand the essence of a person to be, that it's a kind of thing rather than just a pure functional thing. So that might be a start. I don't know what you think of that.
Right. So I think one issue that may come up is that somebody could object that it's arbitrary, because think about a different definition, like a person is a human who has consciousness, or like has consciousness in the past or has had consciousness, something like that. It can explain everything that we want it to explain, but it has no reason to actually accept it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think what I would say here is I would just ask the person a series of questions. And you're right, there can be arbitrary elements to it. I think that also we sort of start with things that are kind of foundational, that we just start with the idea of that there are certain traits that we identify as being personal in nature, rationality, consciousness. And then we have to decide, well, is personhood, is this a type of thing that is acquired accidentally, or is it just more of a substantial property? And since we understand that the value of persons seems to endure in spite of accidental changes, like when you go from infant to toddler to adult, things like that, I think it removes the arbitrary problem there. Because, yeah, I see what you're saying as well. What if somebody just came up with another definition that worked? And people do that. The consciousness one is interesting, because I would almost say to them, I would ask them, well, why have you added a species criteria? Because what's interesting here is the Boethian definition, I would say, is far less arbitrary. For example, under the Boethian definition, if intelligent extraterrestrials, like, well, there's lots of examples one could choose, but if Superman turned out to be real, Krypton was real, and Superman came to Earth, under the definition, he would be a person. Yoda would be a person, baby Yoda, or the child, if you will, from The Mandalorian. Whereas I would critique the other person's view to say, oh, wait a minute, you added a species qualifier to it. Now your thing doesn't really work. What if we had these extraterrestrial beings or things like that that came into it? Then I would say it sounds like the person would probably have to balk and say, fine, I just mean consciousness. And then I think it'll get back to the abilities problem of either excluding or including people by tying it to the present or current use of the ability. Now, you might say, well, the point is not so much the present use of consciousness, but the fact that you had been conscious at least at some point in the past. I would then start to ask, what do you mean by conscious versus just merely sentient? And why does consciousness matter in particular in this arbitrary view? But you're right. I think, though, that to get the reasoning process, we start with foundational elements of what it means to be a person. And then we try to propose a definition that makes the most sense of these foundational intuitions that we have about the nature of personhood that can survive different counterexamples that are thrown at it. So I hope that was helpful. Definitely thank you for bringing that up, Aiden. I would recommend for you and for others, if you want a deeper dive in this, Chris Kaser's book, The Ethics of Abortion, has a lot of great resources on this personhood question that I would highly recommend. Christopher Kaser.
Is it possible to ask just a really quick follow-up?
Yeah, it's just we're almost right out of time, but go real fast.
Okay, so basically Don Marquis, he reviewed Chris Kaser's book, and his argument was that an argument like that inference to the best explanation. It might not work because we haven't necessarily surveyed every possible criterion. So taking away bodily autonomy from women can't be justified when we haven't necessarily surveyed every possible criterion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've read Marquis's review of Cazor, because Marquis starts backwards. His argument against abortion doesn't rely on personhood. It starts with the wrongness of killing. But I think even there, his wrongness of killing account, he can't exclude every criteria there for the wrongness of killing. So I feel like his objection would kind of undercut his own objection to Cazor. But that's the buzzer. Maybe we'll have to talk about it. We go deeper on another call. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Aiden. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Persuasive Pro-Life.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the feast of the dedication of the Basilica of St. John Lateran. Plus news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. You know why I'm saying Cy Kellett like that? I'm emphasizing it because someone reminded me that sometimes it sounds like I'm saying Psych Ellett, and they think, why is he named Psych? So I'm putting that little pause in there today, especially because of the time change. Everything is so confused. I feel upset and out of order.
I feel really bad about the time change side because I was at Founders Weekend with you and got an extra hour in my hotel room. But my wife was home and the children were up at their normal hour, which is an hour earlier.
I never thought about that. They didn't even charge us for that extra hour in the hotel.
Daylight savings time. I don't know. I would say that it is just an absolute bane when you have small children.
No, it's not. It's standard time that's the problem. Just stay on daylight savings time. Just stop all this going back to darkness. Light is better than darkness. I believe, have you ever read John's Gospel?
Grill lobby. The grill lobby has control over Washington. And so they don't want to do that because having grill and charcoal lobby, big charcoal, because daylight savings allows for an extra hour of daylight for grilling in summer. And big charcoal is not going to get rid of that hour because it would cut into their sales.
Big charcoal. Nate in Dallas, Texas, please save me from Trent. Nate in Dallas is watching on YouTube. Glad to have you, Nate. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm sorry, but Trent's going to be there as soon as I'm off the phone. I have a question as a non-Catholic.
I can't see.
Me, on the outside. Oh, gosh. Okay, hold on.
I think the cat fell.
Are you okay?
No, sorry. Everything okay, Nate?
No. I was not aware of people sleeping near me. Excuse me.
Oh, man, Nate, come on. You just woke them up with a Catholic answer. All right, it's all right. It's all going to be okay. They'll forgive you, Nate. Go ahead.
Oh, Si, make sure to play the extra loud trumpet for a new caller. And it's on speakerphone.
I know. So you discovered a sleeping person in your home, Nate, and now we've established that.
Yeah.
Go ahead with your question for Trent.
All right. So from the outside looking in, I remember just back in the 2000s that there was controversy over the stem cell research issue, especially fetal stem cells. And I thought that I remembered the Catholic stance being against all of it, not just proximate material cooperation, or not just remote material cooperation, but all proximate. And so I was wondering, Trent, is it the case that the Catholic position has changed or hardened over time? So like on the Vatican website from the Pontifical Academy for Life, there's an article that has argument three that closes with the third ethical problem can be formulated thus. Is it morally illicit to use ES cells and the differentiated cells from them, which are supplied by other researchers? The answer is negative. And from the USCCB, talking about President Bush's stem cell decision, they say in summation, Catholic teaching rejects all complicity in abortion. And so if it's the case that they've softened over time because now research has paid off and now there's a pandemic and now they don't want to, you know, seem anti-science or have another Galileo type of incident where they're on the wrong side of something.
Well, that's an interesting take. Now, we got these vaccines now that I think Nate is equating that with embryonic stem cell research. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, and I'd have to look at the documents that you're showing, but the church certainly has not changed its teaching that remote material cooperation with evil can be justified if there is a proportional reason. So you are allowed to benefit from a past evil if there is a proportional reason. Some therapeutics for hypothermia were developed by illicit Nazi research on human beings, for example. And we recognize that evil that happened in the past is finished, is not repeated, yet the good that's come from it we can use because we have a proportionate reason. And we're not directly willing in evil, nor are we proximately or like directly cooperating with it. Now, you're asking about embryonic stem cell research. The church has always held that stem cells, the undifferentiated building blocks of cells, these stem cells, if they come from a licit source like adult stem cells, that's morally justified. You go to Dignitatis Personae, I think that was released by the CDF in 2008 or 2009. It says research initiatives involving the use of adult stem cells, since they do not present ethical problems, should be encouraged and supported. However, it does talk about embryonic stem cells. The use of embryonic stem cells, even when these are provided by other researchers through the destruction of embryos or when such cells are commercially available, presents serious problems of cooperation and evil. So you cannot take the actual stem cells themselves, whether you killed the embryo or these are the actual stem cells that were taken from an embryo, and then using that actual material, just, you know, these actual embryos that have been destroyed for research purposes, even if you didn't kill the embryos, if the embryos or their parts have been brought to you, you cannot cooperate at that length. However, in the case we have, there can be other cases where research has been done on aborted embryos or fetuses in the past. And what has occurred today is not experimentation with body parts. And this would be the same thing why you couldn't use fetal body parts that have been taken from, I'd have to go back and look specifically at the language that is that's being used. It is being very clear here. You can't cooperate directly with embryonic stem cell research. Okay, you can't cooperate directly with it. But if it is the case that, let's say, you have cell lines, so these are not the actual aborted fetus or embryo itself, but you have copies of the material, new cells that have been created over time that have developed many, many generations past then. Then those may end up being used in medical treatments or for other things like that. Sometimes they're used to test medicines. Some were used to test the Moderna vaccine or ivermectin, which some people have used as a COVID therapeutic, though there's a lot of some controversy surrounding that. And so this Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has said that those current therapeutics are far enough removed that they have become remote material cooperation rather than proximate material cooperation. So it does get into specific details about what constitutes one or the other. I would recommend, if you would like more resources, definitely go and check out the National Catholic Bioethics Center, that they have a lot of good literature on the fine points of the differences between doing direct experimentation on embryos to remove their stem cells to do research, or aborted fetuses and fetal tissue research, versus doing research in laboratories with, let's say you're doing research on something that was tested with a cell line whose ultimate origin was an abortion many years ago, but that in the span there has been many, many generations of cell lines that have developed, and you're not using the actual illicit material itself. Once again, I'd definitely recommend the National Catholic Bioethics Center to go deeper into that subject.
Thanks, Nate.
So, thanks. Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate that. There's a lot of folks online. I'm going to keep moving. Let's go to Tom in New Jersey watching on YouTube. Hi, Tom. Welcome back. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hello, guys. So you say one of the problems with abortion, or probably the problem, is that it kills a person and it doesn't just let a person die. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, what exactly does it mean to kill someone as opposed to let them die? Now, Trent has on numerous occasions used Philip Befoot's criteria, which is you kill someone if you initiate a fatal sequence of events, but if you just allow an existing fatal sequence to continue, you just let them die. So in the case of abortion, you're initiating a fatal sequence because there was no one before you actually did the abortion. But when you do something like you're kidnapped by the Society of Music Lovers and you unplug yourself from a world famous violinist, that's just letting him die because the fatal sequence started when he got his kidney disease. Does that sound like the correct description of Philip Befoot?
Yeah, that would be part of it. Though, I do think that Foote's analysis is helpful for us to talk about what does it mean. Yeah, I mean, what does it mean to kill someone versus just not saving their life? I mean, if I'm at the beach and there's a morally relevant difference between pushing somebody's head under the water and drowning them, and seeing the guy drowning but not swimming out there to get him. And I think a lot of people would say, well, the difference is the fatal sequence of him drowning already started before you did anything, but he was doing fine and dandy till you shoved his head under the water. So I think that's a part of it, but we might have to specify the description a bit if there's a counterexample to it. I suspect you might have one, but I think that's a decent start.
Yeah, I want to give one right now. So yeah, imagine that Cy Kellett gets this really bad heart disease and he's seconds away from death, but then doctors quickly implant a pacemaker into him and that saves his life. And this pacemaker just has to be kept in him for 9 months and he'll be cured of his disease, and then you can take the pacemaker out and he'll be back to normal. And then let's say sometime before that 9-month period ends, I take out his pacemaker, and then he succumbs to his death and from his disease and he dies. Did I kill Ty or did I just let him die?
Either way, I am not fond of you right now, Tom. But how do you make sense of
that? I didn't initiate the fatal sequence of events.
Well, I guess it would just kind of be like the man who is drowning at the beach. If the lifeguard put him on a floaty and just had to take him to shore, like if I was on another jet ski and I kicked him off the floaty, I would say that I've killed him, even though he's in a state where he's, you know, kind of more dependent, but has been brought back to stability. if you will. So I would say clearly there that you have that if someone is, you know, they have been saved from dying and they've been given a temporary artifact to assist their body parts. And if I were to destroy that artifact, I would say that I would be killing that person. I am curious, do you think then there's a way to, like, to think of the analogy then, would like the pregnant woman sort of, or her uterus kind of be like the pacemaker to the child? I'm trying to see if there's an analogy here.
Well, okay, the pacemaker case, that seems to me almost equivalent to the violinist. Because the violinist, when he's plugged into you,
you're like the pacemaker.
The only difference between the violinist and the pacemaker is that the violinist is being kept alive by your body, whereas in Psy is being kept alive by a device. So,
Trent?
Right, okay. So I see what you're saying here. So the idea is this could have ramifications for if the pacemaker is, if turning off the, if, yeah, well, actually, I think I might have to go back on this because this actually does come up a little bit in bioethics. So I might have to revise my opinion then. Because part of me would want to think, well, also when we think about killing, sometimes we confuse it with murder, or like that's, you know, it's, and you can murder someone either by quote unquote letting them die or killing them. Like if I just didn't feed my 1 year old, it's like, did I let him die or did I kill him? You could argue possibly both. Everybody agrees that it's wrong. I would say that it's killing even though you've left them to their own devices. But in bioethics, this case has come up frequently to talk about whether it is moral to turn for doctors to turn off pacemakers, to turn off artificial hearts, whether the patient no longer wants to use this kind of extraordinary means to stay alive. So I think my original intuition to your thought experiment might have been driven more that it's definitely immoral for me to like go up with a magnet and like shatter Psy's pacemaker, even though there it was a case of me illicitly, because you could argue that it was a case of illicitly letting him die versus actively killing him. In both cases, we'd say it's wrong. Maybe it's the case that the pacemaker, it's still a case of it's keeping someone alive and it's an extraordinary means that you might be able, if it's to turn off someone's artificial heart later, they don't want to use it anymore. That may be something that you could do. And so in that case, you would be allowing a person to die. You're not killing him or her. So I guess, yeah, if we look at it in that way, depending on the case, then it wouldn't really be injurious to the violinist example that also involves the killing versus letting die distinction. But that in both cases, it would be essentially a matter of letting die, and we're not, you know, what is the obligation of this extraordinary means that keeps the other person alive? So I think, Tom, because of your, as in all good philosophy, your excellent question, I have a gut intuitive response that I had to morally process, and now I might have to revise it, that in both cases, we would be letting someone die, but it could still be an illicit or wrong kind of letting guy die that is unjustified, like allowing a bedridden person to starve to death. Tom, always glad when you call in. You give me a good intellectual treadmill.
Good,
I'll think it through
you,
a bit,
Tom.
More, but I think that's
helpful. All right, we got to take a quick break, though. Right back with more Persuasive Pro-Life with Trent Horn.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Life matters. Democrats on Capitol Hill seek to make it easier for women to get an abortion. And public health concerns. The Vatican looks at inequalities across the globe.
Clear, concise, Catholic. EWTN News Nightly with Tracy Sable. Tonight, 9 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost.
The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Big sale going on at shop.catholic.com. $5 flat rate shipping on everything and everything on sale. Just head over to shop.catholic.com and check out all the cool Christmas savings. Seems early for Christmas savings, but it's not because we don't know what the shipping's going to be like. Shop.catholic.com. Trent Horn is our guest this hour. Next hour, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers will be with us, the dynamic deacon. We're going to talk about getting prayer life and family life and work life into balance. Your calls welcome, and it's always great to have Deacon Harold with us. If you haven't listened to him before, you will enjoy him the second hour. This hour, Persuasive Pro-Life, as I said, with Trent Horn. Up next, John in Kentucky, watching on YouTube. John, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, John. My question was, I think you may have briefly mentioned this earlier, but my question was, what should our response be to women who, well, not necessarily women, but people who would say that we don't, as men, deserve a position in this debate? I know a few responses would be, or at least one response would be, you know, the subject of gender, you know, doesn't matter if the issue at hand is murder, or, you know, just because we aren't in the subjective experience of being pregnant, right, does not, you know, logically prove. I just wanted to hear what kind of what thoughts you have about that.
Well, do you have a response? Have you ever responded to this?
Many times, and it has. Sorry, your question's for John.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Anybody, go ahead. How about Trent?
Here, let me offer a thought, John, because I like to have fun with this one sometimes when people say, oh, well, men can't have an opinion on abortion. And then I think I would ask them, why? Why can't men have an opinion on this matter? First, we think people can usually have opinions on anything. What does it matter? Are you saying that? Maybe you mean men can't have a public opinion or vote, or men should not have an opinion on abortion. And I would ask the person, why? Why should men not have an opinion on abortion? And they might say, well, because it does not affect them. And so I have two replies to that. One would be, actually, it seems like abortion does have an effect on men. If a man causes a woman to become pregnant, that is his child. And so it seems like he's in an odd position where she can choose to have an abortion with or without his consent. And so she gets to decide whether his child lives or dies, or she gets to decide whether he pays child support. Or it's interesting, if a woman becomes pregnant, she retains a choice about whether she wants to continue being a parent, but to be a mother, be a parent. But the man does not get that. The woman can decide, no, I'm going to keep this child and you have to pay child support. So it seems like it does affect men, because I would say, how do pregnancies happen without men? It seems like men are involved 50% of the time. Number two, to have fun with this, to say, are you saying then that people are not allowed to have an opinion about something if the issue does not directly affect them, directly? So unless you are capable of having an abortion, unless, you know, you're the one who might end up pregnant needing an abortion, you don't have a right to talk about abortion. Well, by that logic, then, postmenopausal women, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, they have no right to talk about abortion because they're not going to get pregnant. And so-called transgender women would have no right to talk about abortion. Because they, because they're not women. They don't have a uterus. They can't. That's why you'll notice that a lot of these people won't say it's a women's issue. They'll say people who get pregnant should talk about this issue. I was, in fact, reading an article the other day. It is now, this article gave what I consider now to be the worst defense of legal abortion I have ever seen. And I've seen some whoppers. And the defense was saying the Texas law on abortion is wrong because it could cause mental health issues for transgender men. So, of course, a transgender man is a biological woman who claims to be a man. And so what they're saying is that these women who claim to be men, these transgender men, so-called transgender men, if they become pregnant, may experience gender dysphoria, that people will think they're a woman when they're actually a man because they'll see a pregnant individual. And to spare their mental health, they need to be able to have abortions. I will put that as now the one of the worst reasons that I have come across to defend legal abortion. But yeah. And then finally, John, what I would say is to fire back to say, well, that doesn't seem right. You're saying a person can only talk about moral issues he's directly affected by. I mean, that sounds like you can't talk about war crimes unless you are a foreign civilian or a soldier. Unless you're a soldier, you can't talk about war crimes. That's silly. We can say when the military's done something wrong. Or that would be like saying you can't be against racism if you will never be a victim of racism. That doesn't make sense. Or this is my favorite example. That's like saying you can't be against, you can't have an opinion on child abuse unless you have children. Saying that you can't have an opinion on abortion unless you're capable of being pregnant, that's like saying, well, you can't say child abuse is wrong because you've never had a child. You don't know what it's like. Well, when I was single, unmarried, before I knew what it was like to have a child, I knew it was wrong to abuse children, and nothing's going to change that. So it's a terrible argument, but it takes a certain graciousness and assertiveness to help the person see that it's bad and why it's bad. So I hope that's helpful.
And I'm going to leave it there, John, because I want to get to everybody. And we have Adam in Stillwater, Oklahoma, watching on YouTube. Adam, I think you've been waiting for a while. Thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Trent. Big fan, actually. I'm in the middle of your book, Persuasive Pro-Life. So I got into a conversation recently with a friend who's pro-choice. And he believes that the unborn are persons and do have souls. He actually, like, he believes in God. And his entire argument was hinged on, like, should the government be involved in this? And he was just saying, he's using the extreme case of if the mother's life is at risk, and was just saying that in that case, the government shouldn't be involved. It should be the woman's choice. And honestly, I'm sorry, what?
No, just in that extreme case where a woman's life is in danger.
Oh, if it's, well, yeah, I think you should help him see, look, okay, how about in 99% of cases or the vast majority of cases where it's not a life that is at risk, but certain life decisions or life choices, hopefully the person can see, oh yeah, that's totally different. But in that case, even pro-lifers disagree amongst themselves about when abortion should be allowed. Prior to Roe versus Wade, every state in the U.S. that banned abortion had an exception if a woman's life was in danger. So that's very common in the law. Now, Catholics might have a different feeling about what kind of medical interventions are okay or not okay when it comes to a child when it comes to a pregnancy and a woman's life being in danger. But that is a very common pro-life position to say that when it comes to the role of government, it's to protect life. And so maybe in these very narrow cases, government will allow an exception because you're dealing with very gray ethical principles here, very specifically applied principles. But you can help them see that the broader issue is about protecting the unborn, and then we can talk about what to do in these specific hard cases once we've protected the vast majority of unborn human beings.
Adam, thanks. You hear the music, so you see we got to go, but I hope the answer was at least a bit helpful to you or got you started in a certain direction. Trent Horn is our guest. You can find him at TrentHornPodcast.com, one of the most popular and certainly one of the most helpful Catholic podcasts in the world. It's the Council of Trent at TrentHornPodcast.com. Thanks, Trent. Thanks very much.
Good to be here. Thank you, Si.
Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, right after this.